Hi everyone, I'm Laura Kunrether and you are listening to Work, a program where I talk to neighbors about their working lives and the relationship between work and the places we live. What are the different work trajectories that people pursue and what kinds of work bring people to this area? Today, we will listen to a conversation I had with Jim and Meg Cashin at their home on a farm just outside of Hudson. Jim is a retired labor lawyer whose profession concerned other people's work life. Meg is a mother of nine, whose household became the temporary home to dozens of other children in the community. The story they shared with us is a story of generations, beginning with Jim's father, who was in the oil business and bought property in the 1950s in order to have his hands in the land. Meg remembers that he would take a whole handful of seeds and just throw them, broadcast, and it would grow. Now, Jim and Meg's children and grandchildren run one of the largest and earliest organic farms in the area. Their story of work is about the business of cultivating both natural and social resources across the generations, from the global business of oil to the local work of organic farming at the center of their present world.
I've had a varied career. I was a lawyer at law firm Dewey Valentine in New York City.
Right. And that was for labor law, right, in particular?
That was in particular. And then I went to the hospital area.
Uh-huh.
I was assistant general counsel of Blue Cross of New York for a while, and then worked for a foundation that gave away money to hospitals for various projects.
Uh-huh. How did you decide on that area of law?
Okay.
And is there any difference you can imagine between practicing labor law at the time that you started and today?
Sure. I fell into it in a certain way. When I got out of law school, I took a job with the AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, as a lawyer up in their District Council 9, or up in Albany as their representative in Albany with state government and with the legislature and doing grievances, etc. Then I left and went back to Cornell ILR school. I graduated from law school, semester, married Meg. She was going to have a baby, so I decided I need to go back to work. And I happened to know one of the partners at Dewey Valentine from this area, from Hudson.
Oh.
And he gave me a job there. And for the next 3 or 4 years, I worked in the area of labor law.
Were you working in the city before?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was working in the city.
Uh-huh.
And I was asked by somebody, a former union member who had then taken a job with the Public Employment Relations Board, if I would like to do some fact-finding and mediation for the public sector to be paid on an independent contractor basis. And I took that, and I enjoyed that, and then I went into arbitration, which is somewhat similar to mediation and fact-finding, and I started becoming admitted to the various panels, labor arbitration panels that are set up, third parties set up panels of an employers and union, go to those panels and write into the contract that an arbitrator will be appointed pursuant to the rules of the American Arbitration Association, mm-hmm. Public Employment Relations Board, Federal Mediation Conciliation Service, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined them all and started getting cases both in the public and private sector, and for the next 40 years I continued.
Uh-huh.
Once you get in there and get somewhat accepted, it just more or less comes
to
you start getting cases, you know, enough to. And I retired in 1997 from state work, and since then I've been doing labor arbitration mainly.
Yeah. So do you see any differences in the issues or the things that you're working on in labor today than when you began?
Yeah, in several ways. Back then when I first started, arbitration hadn't really caught on to a great degree, especially in the public sector.
I remember a lot of what we talked about last time had to do with, you know, this other work that you do that seems to be related in some ways in terms of the issues to the legal work, but the work that you do in your own home and all of the people that had come through your house. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about that more volunteer side of your work life and how you see them related.
And that, right, it seemed like that a lot of that experience that we were talking about was from the point that you were transitioning to being up here and your family, raising your family here and the property and that kind of relationship to that, to this area.
In 1989 or 1990, we were approached by the Department of Social Services in the county to see whether or not we had agreed to be taking children who were going to be undergoing a very intense psychiatric evaluation, and we would keep them in our homes for a week or two while they were examined by the social service and mental health people.
Well, and why were you approached?
I don't know at the time.
I think you knew Jim Van Alstyn just from the past. Mm-hmm. He was the director of social services.
He was the commissioner of social services.
And he thought you would be amenable to this?
Apparently so, yes. I was involved with Catholic Charities at the time at the local level.
I see. Uh-huh.
I helped form Catholic Charities of Columbia County.
Okay, that makes
sense. So I think he got to know me through that.
I think we also had foster children maybe before that.
Before that, okay.
So what's the explicit relationship between Catholic Charities and the DSS?
Catholic Charities contracts with Department of Social Services to implement a lot of the federal and state and local programs which the county is responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
We, at this point, and it changes over the years what contracts we have, but we do food stamps. I'm sorry, we do WIC, Women, Infants, and Children program.
Mm-hmm.
We do foster care. We do mental health programs. We do alcoholism services. All of those generally through contract with a state or local county agency.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the contact there. But.
And you would be arguing for.
Advocating for.
For the. Foster children.
Or trying to get an increase in benefits, or
right.
Either individually or generically for the group of people who are covered
okay.
and entitled to services.
Okay.
But shortly after having this interview with Van Alstyn, Meg and I, they came back to us and said, you know, what we'd like you to do is something else. We'd like you to be the secure detention home for Columbia County, which meant that those children who were brought into court through usually juvenile delinquency charges or PINs, persons in need of supervision, which are county programs which look at children who are referred to them by their families or by the school or by the police who are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the county decides they cannot stay or should not stay in their home and places them, at that point in time, place them in our house until they determine where best to send them on a more permanent basis.
Mm-hmm.
So starting in 1989 or 1990, we started taking in children and gradually increasing the number that we would take in until at the end, after 11 years, it was about five people. We would take up to five children
at a time,
and we did both men, girls, and boys.
Is that because some of your children had already moved out, and there's more?
That was partially.
A lot of them had gone on to school,
and we were gluttons for punishment.
And so, and over the course of that, those years, that more and more children were staying, and your children were still here in the house. So they were basically all growing up together, your family, they're just part of your family.
There are only really two of our younger children still at home, mm-hmm. full time.
How many children do you have?
Nine.
Nine.
Mm-hmm. And they were, I don't know, in 89, you know, they were grown up by then. Most of them were either in school or working away from home uh-huh. and traveling, whatever. But I do remember how it happened. There was an ad, an article in the paper. They were looking for families who would be interested in working with social services for children with mental health issues.
Which newspaper was that?
In the Register Star. Mm-hmm. And I responded.
Did you always have an interest in a kind of social work sort of work? Did you, you know, from when you were younger? Or?
Yes, I guess you could say so. Yeah, I mean, we've always had extended family
right.
living with us.
Okay.
So
students from other countries.
We have a lot of exchange students. I read in another paper, it was a Catholic paper, they were looking for families who would take in families from another country.
Refugees.
And we took in a refugee family from Poland for a year.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
We took in Vietnamese refugees.
Yeah.
And in your families, did you have multiple generations living together as well, or is there some relationship to your own family?
No.
That
I did in my family, but
not outside your
but
family.
That wasn't really it was all family. Grandmothers and aunts and uncles lived down in Westchester, grew up in Westchester.
Uh-huh.
And it's true, so.
But you didn't have, did you also come from a big family?
A family of five children.
Uh-huh.
But I was probably the only one that would do this kind of thing.
We're viewed as the
there she goes
different.
Again.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we started that work taking in kids and continued it till about 2001, 2002.
Now, did you, was there, I'm interested in the relation between this sort of the work it would take to, you know, take in these children and all that was involved in that, you know, from daily tasks to, you know, what it requires, you know, these children sounded like they were going through some pretty
difficult
situations. Mm-hmm. And then also how that relates to then when you ended up going into the arbitration hall or the other places in which you would be encountering perhaps people in similar situations, but you know, did that affect, you know, so those two things.
There is a connection.
There is a connection. And what was the work that you found yourself perhaps not knowing about?
Well, let Meg's talk about how it was with the kids that we took in and what.
It was good. It was good for us, good for our family.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was good for the children that came here. They were very damaged children, many of them. They didn't like us. They felt like we were their warden or they were prisoners here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them ran away from home, from here, and we were told not to go after them, which we didn't do.
How old were they generally?
Mostly, everybody seemed to be 14. We had some really interesting. It was good because the kids. It was so strange to them to live here, that it was like they didn't know what to make of it. You know, it was, and to sit down and eat dinner together every night and say grace, hold hands. That was all new. If for any reason we skipped that stage, they would say we didn't say grace. I mean, that was after they'd been here for a while.
Right.
And they stayed various lengths of time.
They would go to school, so we were not the favorite parents knocking on the door of Akawamik, because we'd say, we've got two more kids, they need to be enrolled. And there's a continual entry and then exit from school for these kids who were at our house for usually 4 or 5 days, but sometimes up to 3 or 4, even 6 months.
Uh-huh.
So they went to school every day.
Okay.
Unless they were ill. So they were out of the house. It wasn't that we had to be here during the day, usually, unless they were.
I was actually substituting at the time.
Oh.
And I could get called at Rojan, the school down in Hillsdale, and say, you got to come and take this kid home. He's, you know, he's getting kicked out of school, or something like that would happen.
Wow.
Not often, but that also was, they wouldn't, you know, if the kid was really acting out, they would not let them stay. But the kids liked the school. It was different. It wasn't Hudson. It wasn't Catskill. It was Akawamik. It was more farmy kids. And they kind of, you know, it was like new kid on the block. They were popular.
Right.
They played sports.
Right.
They, yeah, there was a lot of interesting things that happened as a result. And sometimes they, even some of the ones that ran away, came back and said, I don't know why I did that. I really didn't, you know, peer pressure or whatever would come into play.
Tell me, do you really know your brother, man? Cause their heart speaks louder than a color can. And why would you even shake a man's hand if you're not going to help him stand?
The relation between your children and the children who are coming in?
Our son, Chris, who's the farmer now, he's 36 now, he was great because he was a role model. He was in high school, he played football, he kissed his mother goodbye sometimes when he left. So it was like, what is going on here? This nice, cool kid.
Right.
Is acting, you know, weird in their estimation. But they liked him, and he was good with them. He just accepted them as living, because he had a lot of people live here
right.
over his
normal
life. So it wasn't so unusual.
But he also was able to kind of be the police. I mean, we would get him to intervene. If we felt that he had a better rapport or was a better able to communicate with the individual children. Mm-hmm. So we used him at times, not frequently.
You know, he would just overhear them talking to me, maybe, and not being polite or being disrespectful, and he'd say, "Don't talk to my mother like that." And that was like, that would stop him.
Usually, yeah.
No, I mean, mostly kids, I'd say in general, these were good kids. They weren't bad. Mm-hmm. They weren't bad. Mm-hmm. They were just hurting.
Although, as the years went on, over the 11 years, 10 or 11 years, we had children in this program, the kids became tougher. Their reasons for being in the system were a lot more serious than they were initially. It involved maybe stealing or burglary or vandalism, mm-hmm. or really very traumatic experiences with their family or with foster parents, etc. So, and that's one of the main reason why we stopped doing it in 2001 or so, because the kids really became too difficult for just a couple handling, because in all of the other counties around the state, there were group homes where staff on 8-hour shifts would tend to these kids. Mm-hmm. We were the only, as it turned out, I think the only county that used a family, one family, to be present 24/7.
Right.
And tend to the kids, and they realized it was getting tougher. We did, and we finally said, after Meg was attacked and hit over the head with a candelabra and had to go to the hospital and all that, that we had reached the end of our rope.
Do you have any thoughts on why that shift? What was going on?
No, I think it's just, it's reflective of the society, I think. Mm-hmm. Kids in school, just the general school population, I think is much more difficult to deal with these days. Problems are a lot more severe and a lot more common than they were. And that, you can talk about a whole lot of things, you know, societal changes, just the freedom the kids believe they should have, and the lack of a family environment, which causes family dysfunction in a lot of homes, especially the lower socioeconomic families, although our population certainly wasn't limited to that, but the majority of kids came here through families that were not functioning very well, and their personalities and their problems manifested themselves either within the family or the school, or usually both. Until they came to the attention of the Department of Social Services, when a petition would be filed to take away the custody from the natural parents or the foster parents and place them in a more secure facility, which was deemed to be our house. But now our daughter, who was home at the same time as our son, had a different experience than all that make.
Yeah, well, our youngest daughter, she did not enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And so her older sister was out in California, and she decided, I'm going to spend my last year of school. And she didn't like the school here either. Mm. And so she decided to go out and live with this family, with friends of ours, and her sister, her older sister, and go to school and finish out there.
Now, as far as the carryover in my work life, really, the experiences as a provider of services in our home had very little impact on my work as an arbitrator. There just wasn't that much of a similarity, and I probably gained some insights as a result of understanding people, how they acted and why they acted certain ways. But it did help me in my work with Catholic Charities, because I was working with a lot of the kids who were in the same programs, entitlement programs.
Right, that's what
that
I was thinking.
I was advocating for through Catholic Charities at the state and federal level.
Oh.
So that it did give me knowledge and understanding of the various systems
I see.
Especially in child care and family,
mm-hmm.
social services, and that helped me. So
mm-hmm.
that was.
I when we first came to Hudson, I recall that one of the big debates or things sort of circulating in the community was the number of children who end up in foster care here, that there's a greater number, and that some folks felt that there were too many people who ended up in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you must have been to some degree involved either through the legal work or through just your experience in your home. What is your sense of that now, and if that's at all in your experience the case? Or I know that there certainly was debate about it that I heard about.
Yes, I think it's the breakdown of the family. I mean, that's my.
But I yeah, I'm sorry.
My take on it.
It is, and I think that either the department here in the county was more involved in placement of children, getting them out of their homes, as opposed to other counties who worked more in trying to keep the children and
yes,
their families.
That's right.
And provide support. So that was one reason.
Yeah.
The other is that the population demographics of a large lower class in the few cities or towns here where there was a population of people who were not as well educated, didn't work, or had menial jobs, larger, I guess, than other counties. But you're right, percentage-wise, Columbia County had then and still does a greater percentage of children going into social services, at least the last time I heard any records that was the case. But
and I'm just also interested in your position as parents, and just if you ever had an experience where you felt, was it always for you a sense that, thank God we can provide a safe place, or did you ever think about losing your child in some way? Was that ever part of the whole, as a parent, thinking about, you know,
mm-hmm.
these children, you know, being basically forced away from their parents? And I don't know what kind of relationship you had with, or any, probably none, with the parents, but I'm just,
we did,
you know,
have a lot of contact with the parents.
Uh-huh, you did.
They came to visit often.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Depending upon the situation.
Yeah, sometimes they didn't have a car, but, you know, they'd get a ride out, and, you know, they'd have birthday parties here. They'd have, you know, bring cakes and McDonald's food, and
mm-hmm.
I would, you know, stay away from the pool because they were having a party, and I wanted them to have a party.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a wonderful thing for them to be able to, you know, visit their child and
mm-hmm.
celebrate some special occasion.
Quite frankly, a lot of the children didn't have active parents involved with them. So many of the parents we did not meet
mm-hmm.
because they just were not that interested in seeing the kids. Or part of the main reason they were here was because of problems with their natural parents.
Mm.
And so they were placed because they couldn't get along.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship, family relationship, was already pretty broken,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't any great effort on the part of either the parents or the department to try to force it to happen, although the parents were always encouraged
mm-hmm.
to take a role in it with their children, even if they hadn't been the best parents.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the parents were, I think, just as happy that what was seen as a problem child was out of the household.
It wasn't so much unusual because so many of their friends were in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
Other children in placement, whether they were already at Berkshire Farm or some other place,
mm-hmm.
there was places all over the state where they would send these kids after they left here.
Mm-hmm.
They would stay here until they got their court date decided on where they were going to go next. Were they going to go back home, or were they going to be placed for a year or 18 months in a place like Berkshire Farm. And many, many of the boys went to Berkshire Farm. They played basketball. Mm-hmm. Our son Chris used to write for the Independent newspaper, and he followed all the games, including Berkshire Farm. And they put these kids together for very short periods of time, and yet they had winning teams. They were good athletes, and they played. We had a basketball court, mm-hmm. and they, you know, they went sleigh riding, they went swimming, they mm-hmm. went down the stream on rafts, and, you know, I mean, it was kind of almost a vacation for them.
Because they knew also they were here temporarily.
Yeah, it was temporary, and some of them enjoyed it immensely, and others didn't like it at all.
So for those, the kids that, I guess the ones that had a more positive experience, did you have contact with them once they left?
We just went to a wedding of one of the young men that was here. Uh-huh. He was getting married.
He's 30 now, isn't he? Around 20?
He's about 30, yeah. He was in his teens. And he already has four children. He's marrying the mother of his four children. Uh-huh. And so it was very important to him that we come to the wedding.
And there have been several other kids that we've
We meet them in CVS or right. on the street, or
yeah.
Kelly tells me, oh, so-and-so's had another baby, you know, someone that was here. And
A lot of the families, we have children from the same family, so we would have three or four siblings over a period of 6 or 7, 8
mm-hmm.
years
mm-hmm.
who would come. You know, obviously the parents were not functioning as they should have, or economic situations.
Yeah.
Overwhelmed the family, so mm-hmm. as the kids got older and got more difficult to handle, both in the school and the family, they would find their way here. They would find their way, first of all, under the court system,
right.
and then here.
The time to rise has been.
Fortunate when we bought the farm, when we moved up here in 1973 with 8 of our children. Our youngest was born up here, but we came up from Long Island, and this was in the family already, the farm. My brother and I owned it together at that point, so we had the farm, and we came up, and I started working in Albany, and we moved here first, thinking that probably we would move closer to Albany to my job. Well, as it turned out, once the kids were here on a regular basis.
And you had been coming here already?
We had been coming here summers and vacations, and
right.
so the kids knew the area, and but they took to the farm, and we had 7 or 8 horses, and they were all in the 4-H and pony clubs and
mm-hmm.
did all sorts of things. So the longer we stayed, the more it was clear that it was meant to be that we lived here.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first moved here, the farmer up the road, a dairy farmer, used our land and our barns for an expansion of his farm up the road. Mm-hmm. And then in 1989, or thereabouts, one of our daughters, Kelly, married a gentleman from Holland, and they had worked together in one of the Camp Hill villages around the country in Minnesota, and then moved to this area, and Jean-Paul Cortens and Kelly became the farmers over at Hawthorne Valley School, Hawthorne Valley Farm, and then moved over here and started the organic farm, biodynamic farm, here in around 1989 or 90. And they maintained the farm and became more and more successful until 1999 or 2000.
Had it been functioning as a farm ever
It was
before?
Functioning as a farm, mm-hmm. but as a dairy farm. So it wasn't used in an organic farming way. Mm-hmm. But in 1999 or 2000, Jean-Paul and Kelly separated and divorced. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't appropriate for Jean-Paul to remain here farming when he and Kelly were no longer living together as husband and wife. Mm-hmm. So after about a year where he stayed on and finished up a season, he moved up to Kinderhook, where he now operates what used to be Roxbury Farm here from here.
Oh.
Up there, right opposite the old Toyota.
He kept the name. It's right next to Martin Van Buren.
Yes, I think I've seen it.
You know the
area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he moved there, and fortunately for us, our youngest son, Chris, had finished college and was living and working in Ghent and Chatham area.
Katie Smith, Chris's wife, she lived here when we had the DSS kids. Because she was an apprentice on Roxbury Farm.
Oh.
So she lived here for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And along the way, she's a little older than Chris, but along the way, they got together.
Uh-huh.
And she was very interested in farming, always was.
On her own.
And Chris always farmed in the summertime, just for a summer job.
Right.
But he wasn't a diehard farmer.
Right.
And Katie was. And they got married and... You know, it's just they moved in and moved into the barn, which was converted. It was converted by us for apprentices because we always had apprentices that either lived here or in the barn, depending on the number. So, so they've been living there for the last 10 years and raising their 4 children.
And they quickly established themselves. Well, they were. Katie already was farming over in Joe Gilbert's farm in Chatham, which is called
the Berry Farm.
The Berry Farm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Katie was the resident gardener of the land over there. And Chris had joined her and was helping her, so they both moved over here. And we are very fortunate because Jean-Paul and Kelly had worked with the farm and the land so that already it was an organic farm.
Right, right.
So he came in, and we already had customers and clients, and so he came in, and they kind of hit the road running, and they've expanded the farm terrifically, and now the 200 acres that comprise the farm, we've now maxed out on land use. So they're looking to, considering looking to augment the property that they farm by rental or by buying additional land, because the farmland that's amenable to vegetables and growth is used up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This lower field that's nearest the stream, you're familiar with that, is totally flooded.
It's,
and Chris isn't going to farm that anymore the way he has been.
Yeah.
It's just too risky.
Yeah, sure. It's happened several times. Now, was it when it was your father who bought this property?
My father and mother bought it in 1950.
Uh-huh.
And my father was one of those who was called gentleman farmers.
Uh-huh.
He had a job in New York City, and our family lived in Westchester. And but he wanted to get out of business. He was in the oil business. And so he moved up here. My uncle and his wife, my aunt and uncle, had bought a farm over in Ghent, Austerlitz area. So they found this farm for my family in 1950. They bought the farm and started operating it as a dairy farm on an absentee basis because mm-hmm. my father was still working in New York City mm-hmm. and actually didn't want to be a full-time farmer. So we had tenants here who managed and worked the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for about 7 or 8 years. But around 1960 or so, my brother and I realized that we couldn't, it wasn't viable to financially to operate the farm on an absentee basis where it was a dairy farm especially.
Mm-hmm.
Dairy farm then as it is now is a very difficult business to operate from a financial aspect as well as from the social. So we were fortunate in having the farm next to us want our land and buildings. So we were able to work out a lease arrangement that covered the costs
uh-huh.
for the farm. So we would use it just for weekends and summers.
Mm-hmm.
My brother, who had a greater affinity to the farm, would also use it. But we would come up for periods of time during the summer. It was our family who mostly used it with all of our kids. We would spend the summer up here
mm-hmm.
for 3 or 4 years before we
mm-hmm.
bought the farm.
So was your father among a group of people at that time in the 1950s who were sort of imagining farming as a hobby, a kind of thing? I mean, there were
yeah.
others like him that
yeah.
were
yeah.
kind
yeah.
of buying up.
Although there wasn't a large number of those persons, I don't think. I really have never looked at the demographics.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think that's always been the case, you know, people
right.
who are always had a hidden desire to
yes.
get back to the land or something.
Yeah.
Especially if you grew up in Brooklyn. And
yeah.
yeah.
And then all of a sudden you, you know, own property that can be. He liked to plant, too. He would take a whole, I remember, take a whole handful of seeds and just throw them
uh-huh.
broadcast.
Yeah.
And it would grow. I mean, he had a green thumb.
Yeah.
But it was a fun thing for him. And.
But yet he didn't want to do it full time.
No.
And he
right.
didn't have the talents or the experience
no.
to do it full time.
Right.
But he liked to show it off.
He liked to.
And how did it run more when it was under your operation?
Well, first of all, it was less expensive because our children ran it, you know, and we didn't have to pay out salary, didn't have to rent a house.
Right.
Land, so that it, from a financial standpoint, it was better that way. Plus the fact that, you know, was more in sync with what we wanted the farm to be.
Mm.
We didn't have that much control when we had to lease it out
right.
or have people work it.
Right.
You know, now we were hands-on with my son-in-law, Jean-Paul, first, and then with Chris and Katie
mm-hmm.
when they came and took over.
Mm. And so now, there, how many people are employed by the farm?
7.
Mm-hmm.
8.
8.
And do they come from the area? Or?
Well, there's 3, 6, 7 men from Guatemala here,
mm-hmm.
and one from this area,
mm-hmm.
who's going to become a full-time year-round person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chris would have to promise him year-round work,
mm-hmm.
not just this, because the men go back in November. But
they come in April, May.
But the man that was here last season, he couldn't go back and then come back again because of his visa problems. He now wants to stay another season. So I don't know how it may end up that he'd have 2 people on a payroll
right.
all winter.
Since the last 12 or 13 years, we've added cattle, beef cattle.
Oh, uh-huh.
So it's not just vegetables, but it's beef that we raise. We have about 30, 35 cows at any
mm-hmm.
given point. And which we sell as organic meat.
Mm-hmm.
So you need somebody here full time
right.
to feed
those horses,
animals. And now, of course, with the younger children, we have 12 grandchildren living on the farm.
Uh-huh.
Here are 5 of our children
uh-huh.
and their families who live on the farm in their own residences.
So the majority of your children did stay here.
Five
well, they came
nine.
Back. None of them stayed here originally. Uh-huh. They all went off. Like, yeah. Joey was all over the world, and she's next door now. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, that is amazing.
And it's
and there's actually a sixth in the area, our daughter Kelly, who was the farmer here originally, lives nearby, so she's here a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
So we have six of our nine children in the area with their families, and the 12 grandchildren from five different families who live on the farm property are all homeschooled.
Right.
So there's a lot of activity with our own grandchildren plus children who participate in the homeschooling from other families in other areas of the county who come here.
Is that something that you had done at all here?
No.
No, never.
Never.
It never even came up.
didn't occur to you?
No, I don't think it was happening even when our kids were growing up. I mean, I didn't know about it if it was. I mean, I'm sure there were little pockets maybe of people in their little hometown places, but you know, I'd never even heard of homeschooling.
But our kids have very strong feelings about education, about how to do it and how not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And public schools, at least the public school in this area, was not something that they thought was beneficial in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to talk down the school district, but our children found it not to be the most appropriate environment to have the context, the right context, and the values. Most of the parents are children who live on the farm were very impressed with the Waldorf education being taught over to Hawthorne Valley, and most of them use to a greater or lesser extent the theories and the practices and the procedures of educating a child that are inherent in the Waldorf system. Including especially the fact that the teacher stays with the with a child from first grade through, in our case, 12th grade. But it's amazing to us to see, to perceive what we believe are the benefits of having been raised in a homeschool environment, which is full of values, and where the classroom is the farm, really.
Right. Yeah.
Because Waldorf education and a lot of other educational theories talk about using the community, you know, whether it be the farm or the village or whatever.
So that does relate a lot to their experience. They're kind of combining the agricultural environment and the extended family and.
Exactly.
Yeah. But also when they, like our oldest granddaughter who's homeschooled. She's very creative when it comes to getting all the things that she needs. And her parents, of course, are very supportive and help her do it. But she went to the John Hopkins for a couple of years in the summertime, took these classes that were, you know, gave her credits. She goes to Columbia Green. She's mentoring some of the people in her class at Columbia Green, tutoring, I guess, is what she's doing. These are women with children that are trying to get their associate's degree, and she's helping them at 17.
Yeah.
And you know, they say, oh, I should be able to do this. She said, all I have to do is go to school. I don't have to raise children. I don't, you know, she doesn't have those other responsibilities, so she's free to, and she's a very just ambitious as well, very motivated.
Mm-hmm.
The school industry in Columbia County, as in many other geographic areas, has really mushroomed.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of alternative ways to educate a child. And all of our five families who are involved in homeschooling, to a greater or lesser extent, use the families, or they cooperate with families in the community for classes, you know, on American history or English or something, where 10 or 12 children of the same age will go to somebody's house.
Right.
It's constantly changing.
It's a very big community.
I think we are blessed with being in Columbia County at a point in time of history where there's been an explosion of culture, mm-hmm. education, diversity
right.
in the area, and we have benefited and continue to benefit from that, and it's provided a lot of activities, social, cultural, educational, community activities where we've gotten involved. We've been involved with the Friends of Hudson. I was president of Friends of Hudson for a while mm-hmm. and fighting the cement plant and a lot of other things that, you know, have really made our lives a lot more engaging.
Let's drink to the hard-working people. Let's think of the lowly of birth. Raise your glass to the good and the evil. Let's drink to the salt of the earth. Say a prayer for the common foot soldier. Spare a thought for his back-breaking work. Spare a thought for his wife and his children. To burn the fires and to still till the earth. This faceless crowd, a swirling mass of gray, blue, black, and white. They don't look real to me. In fact, we all look so strange. Yeah, raise your glass to the hardworking people. Let's drink to the uncounted heads. Gamblers instead. Spare a thought for the stay-at-home voter. Empty eyes need the strength theory show. At the rates of gray-suited grafters, a choice of cancer or polio. Crowd, a swirling mass of gray and black and white. Do we all look real to you? Or do we look too strange? Yeah, let's drink to the hardworking people. Let's think of the glory of birth.
Thinking about as you're talking and thinking about the trajectory, I'm always interested in how people came to where they are and they're not necessarily expected ways. I was just curious about the, a lot of the stuff that you've been doing is very environmentally centered on the land, organic farming, and then you said you your father was in the oil business. And did that have any effect on you in terms of choices? Was that a part, was there any kind of discussion in your family as
no.
a young person about the land and?
No, we were not really concerned about environment back when I was a youngster. And my father just wanted to be, have his hands in the dirt and be a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
But there was very little consciousness
mm-hmm.
about environment until we were well into our married life. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the more as we, 80s, starting in the 80s, I guess, especially
mm-hmm.
up to the present,
mm-hmm.
we've been
I think it's more and more learning through our children mostly.
Yeah.
Right.
I wouldn't say we were the ones that started it. They were the ones that brought it to us. It's kind of nice to see the kids picking up.
Yeah.
Because we'll be leaving off.
Well, it is interesting, though, that just incidentally how separate from the issues of impact that they're like this connection of generations of looking at natural resources and kind of the business of natural resources.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very important part of our psyche at this point in time. I mean, I get upset, but we tend to, fortunately, we've been able to kind of think globally, act locally in that.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems that we're facing as a nation, environmentally, economically, et cetera, and the world problems, I more and more, at least I have, and you always have, Meg, I think, that although that captured me at one point in time, I tend to think about acting locally and what we can do
mm-hmm.
to change things local.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so frustrating if you do go to a national or a international level of what you can do
yeah.
to change your what's happening in the world. You can at a local level. Your goals, you learn that your goals should be a lot more modest.
Jim and Meg's story moves from the work of arbitrating legal disputes in a professional setting to the work of caring for their own and others' children through the Department of Social Services, from the work of tilling the land to the work of homeschooling, with five of their children living on the same property bought more than 60 years ago. They have engaged in a complex composite of work, professional, volunteer, and familial.